For a while, there was a cynical joke going around. Someone would say, it's just not safe to drink the water anymore, or eat the food, or breathe the air. In fact, it's just not safe to be here anymore. Well, as far as I know, nobody ever laughed at that. On this edition of Conversations, things we thought were safe that aren't. We'll look at asbestos, and perhaps even more chillingly, electricity, and some of the other hazards we never expected to find in everyday life. Welcome, please, investigative journalist Paul Brodeur. He's the man who broke the story on asbestos, senior staff writer for The New Yorker. Paul, welcome, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
I want to start with asbestos because it is, in some ways, still a very big story. Because we're going to spend a good deal of time on the darker side of asbestos, I want to look at why it has been considered the miracle mineral since 2,000 years.
Yes, it's been called the magic mineral since around the time of Christ when Strabo, the Greek geographer, and Pliny wrote about a sickness of lungs in slaves whose occupation it was to weave asbestos into cloth. Asbestos was inextinguishable, so it was used in the wicks of the candles of the Vestal Virgins. And it was woven into cloth. Charlemagne is said to have thrown a stained asbestos tablecloth into the fire to impress some unruly chieftains, because when it was withdrawn, it was unscathed. And then the stuff fell out of use during the Middle Ages, the Dark Ages. But when the Industrial Revolution came along, asbestos immediately had enormous uses because it's indestructible in nature. It withstands the fiercest heat. It looks and feels as light as eiderdown or thistledown, yet a single strand of it, fiber, has the strength of a piano wire. It can be woven, as I've said, into cloth, and it withstands such enormous heat. It's a terrific fire retardant, but because it's so strong, it acts as a binder. For example, it's used in plastic garbage bags to strengthen them. It's used in all kinds of plastic products to give them strength as a binder. It's used in water pipe everywhere, all over Alaska and everywhere in the lower 48, to give strength to the concrete in the water pipe. And that's how, of course, it gets into the water, because it leaches out when the water's acid. So asbestos has these extraordinary properties. It's a fiber of stone is what it is, a mineral fiber of stone. And however, because it's eminently respirable, for example, a million little fibers lie along a linear inch of chrysotile asbestos. In that same inch, you can only align 630 human hairs. So you get some idea of how eminently respirable and microscopic it is. So it finds its way into the lungs, where, because it remains as indestructible as it does in nature, it wreaks terrible havoc. When it gets into the lungs, it acts progressively for your whole lifetime because it just stays there, scarring the tissue and causing cancer.
Huh. This is Paul Brodeur. We're talking about asbestos on Conversations. When Pliny the Elder and Strabo discovered that the slaves were having trouble breathing and were dying off, was it because that it was a slave class of people that it wasn't very disturbing? Or am I misinterpreting?
No, I'm sure you're right. If it had been the Roman nobles, they might have been much more upset. They just noticed this in passing, by the way. But it's interesting to note that 2,000 years later, at the turn of this century, when workers began to die of it in France and in England, not much attention was paid because, in a sense, in the modern society, mm-hmm. workers, blue-collar people, factory workers, were at the lowest end of the totem pole. In fact, asbestos really did not become a major concern, political and a concern in the country, until it was suddenly discovered in the 1980s that asbestos was everywhere in our schools, particularly in our schools. And then the middle class in the United States got terribly upset about it, and the Congress passed all kinds of laws. But all during the 70s, we knew, I'd written two or three books about the extraordinary casualty rate of 750,000 American workers dead of this one substance, another 500,000 going to die in the next 20 to 30 years. But it wasn't until it got into the schools that people thought, oh my God, this is dangerous, this is terrible, we have to do something about this. So from the Roman times to this, you have this stratification society about who you're going to get worried about. Sure, I think it's a good point.
Mm-hmm. Did you make a point in the book that we, I'm not quite sure how you put it, but it seems to me that we learn about dangers of something and then we forget. We learn and forget and learn and forget era to era, country to country.
Well, yes, there's no institutional memory for this kind of thing. For example, when I began to write about asbestos 26 years ago in The New Yorker, I think it was the very first major piece ever written, the industry was trying to claim that chrysotile asbestos, which is a kind of asbestos mined in Canada and in some places in the United States, but chiefly in Canada, and which accounts for 95% of the world's production and 95% of all the asbestos used in the United States that has been used, industry was trying to claim that that this asbestos wasn't as hazardous as some of the other asbestos, the amosite and chrysotile asbestos that came from South Africa and Rhodesia. And that whole notion was blown out of the water by the great epidemiologist Irving J. Selikoff, who pointed out that if all the disease that was occurring, massive amount of disease that was occurring among the asbestos workers, was due only to the 5% of African asbestos that was being brought into the country, that African asbestos would have to be one of the most potent carcinogens ever known to man. And they just stopped claiming that. Then 20 years later now, all of a sudden, the asbestos industry has hired, financed, scientists at University of Vermont at Yale, and they've done this study trying to claim again that chrysotile asbestos isn't hazardous. And so some of the people that were here at the symposium in Fairbanks, Anthony Mazzocchi of the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers Union, and people at Mount Sinai Hospital and other scientists in the government, are having, after all these years, to reorganize and carry on another campaign to try to bring forth all the medical evidence, and it's just voluminous, stacks of it, to show that chrysotile asbestos is, of course, enormously hazardous to breathe. So when you have this kind of forgetting, this lack of institutional memory in the country, largely due to the fact that newspapers don't write about this stuff, and people, you know, it just doesn't stay up in people's minds. After a generation, people forget about it, and then the old guys resurrect it and try to rehabilitate it, because you see, it's big money. Asbestos is incredibly inexpensive, and yet when they mine and mill it and sell it, and now they're selling it all over the third world, it's essentially banned in the United States. There's a de facto ban. The reason it's a de facto ban is that no engineer and no architect in his right mind would put it into a building.
So we won't use, the United States won't use the product
anymore,
made from asbestos.
No, there are very few uses. Some uses are allowed in water pipe for the strengthening bond, and in gaskets, some kinds of gaskets, and in brake linings, some kinds of brake linings. But basically, asbestos, the levels of asbestos used in the United States last year were back to where they were in 1913, down from the 800 million tons or whatever that was used in the early 1980s when it was sprayed on all the buildings and the rest of it. But Canada's exporting it fast as they can mine and mill it to Thailand, the Philippines, Korea, India, and they're setting up huge asbestos factories. One is very cynical.
Well, I have a question for you that may require us to go back at least to the 1960s, when mm-hmm. a 40-ish-year-old Cajun man walked into the law offices of Ward Stevenson. Mm-hmm. But I want to start where we are.
Sure.
Are the mining conditions for the miners any safer than they were for that Cajun man that I want you to tell me about?
No, they really can't be. I mean, because in the huge open pit asbestos mines of asbestos, that's the name of the town, in eastern townships of Quebec, just the environmental exposure is tremendous. The whole town is situated downwind of this enormous pit that's 1,200 feet deep and a mile across. I mean, it's one of the great open pit mines of the world. And so you're always going to get problems in the mining and milling. I'm sure there's much better dust suppression in the milling and shaking operations, where they actually shake the asbestos fiber out of the ore and the stone. And I'm sure the respirators are better now. The Canadian government has mandated that. But you still have tremendous exposures up there and continuing disease.
And so anyone who breathes is breathing this.
Yes, literally. And of course, and sometimes you don't have to be in an open mind. You can be in a building where if they are removing asbestos improperly and haven't evacuated the building or sealed it off properly, you can get enormous exposure to asbestos when they start tearing it out. And early on, 15 years ago, when they began to tear asbestos out of buildings, you had no rules implemented by the EPA, so you had terrible exposures.
Tell me about Mr. Tomplay.
Tomplay was the first, one of the first workers to file third-party lawsuit. You see, under the workman's comp, once you go back and point out that at the turn of the century, steel workers were suing their employers for the terrible conditions that were occurring in steel plants where people were being killed every day and in other major industrial manufacturing. And so industry got together and decided that, hey, we can't keep getting sued this way individually. Let's have a scheme called workman's compensation where a worker is not allowed to sue his individual employer, but he can get compensation for certain kinds of diseases and accidents, and it'll get money to the widow faster or to the disabled worker. Well, the workman's compensation scheme, as I have described it in Outrageous Misconduct, was simply an adversarial situation that has allowed industry to injure workers for all these years and pay them a pittance and not pay them very quickly at all. The point being, however, that in the middle 1960s, there was a restatement of tort law, and a strict liability, which is a concept that began in the Middle Ages when vintners and victualers were people who purveyed food and drug, were required to show that their wares were safe, and the penalty was death if you sold adulterated wine in many, many towns in the Middle Ages or bad food. So these vintners and victualers went around sipping their wines and nibbling their wares and testing their products, to make sure they were okay. And in this century, gradually, at the beginning of the century, because of the terrible cancer-producing stuff that was put into cosmetics and into drugs, the drugs and cosmetics manufacturers were required to test their products and to know that they were not going to be hazardous. And then gradually, by 1965, this was increased and applied to all manufactured products. Today, under the laws of product liability, strict liability in the United States, a manufacturer, maker of any good, is required to know what the long-term and short-term medical effects of that are and to put a warning label on it if it is dangerous, hence the stuff that you use to unplug, clog, sink drains, says, keep out of the reach of children, do not drink, and there's a big skull and crossbones on it. And if the manufacturer puts a warning label on this, warning the potential user, consumer, that it's dangerous, or the worker that's using it, that it's dangerous, he's okay. But the asbestos people never put any warning label on. So all these big bales and bags of raw asbestos came to all these fabrication plants in the United States. Some of them were making cement pipe, others were making brakes or whatnot else. There wasn't a bit of warning. So the bags were dumped into hoppers and the stuff was mixed, and the exposures were extraordinary. And then the finished products didn't bear any label. So when these molded pipe fittings came to the men working in shipyards and were cut with saws, men and women, 5 million in the wartime shipyards alone, and were molded around the pipes in the confines of vessels, the close quarters of the hulls, enormous exposures, not just of the insulators, but of everybody working around them. So you soon had 20 million Americans, 25 million Americans, with serious, significant occupational exposure to asbestos.
This is where you get the numbers, because all the way down the line, someone's handling something that's hazardous.
Exactly. And so you had this ubiquitous substance with a lot of uses. You had a workforce enormously exposed to it. And to this one substance, you've had something in the order of 25 million Americans since the Second World War significantly exposed with what is now going to be a huge disease rate. They're estimating about 500,000 people in the next 20 to 30 years will die of asbestos-related cancer alone. That doesn't count scarring of the lungs. And that perhaps as many as 500,000 to 750,000 are dead already of wholly preventable disease, because this was known 50, 60 years ago. The deadly quality of asbestos was known by the industry and by many members of the medical profession and by the insurance industry.
This is Paul Brodeur. He mentioned his book, Outrageous Misconduct. It came out from Pantheon, in 1985, subtitled The Asbestos Industry on Trial. Before that, Expendable Americans took a look at those who became ill and died. Viking Press put that out in 74, and by Ballantyne in 1972, the first book he put out on this subject, Asbestos and Enzymes. He's written extensively on asbestos, on electricity, and other hazards in our life. Paul Brodeur, investigative reporter, is here with us on Conversations. You have said that, the title of this book, Outrageous Misconduct, that the asbestos corporations colluded and conspired to make sure that they made the greatest number of profits without revealing true information about asbestos. How so?
Yes, the industry knew in the early 1930s that asbestos was a tremendous hazard, that it caused irreversible and incurable lung disease. And in my book, I cite chapter and verse of corporate minutes, correspondence, all kinds of documents. It's written entirely out of the documentary evidence that this collusion was taking place and that the workers weren't informed. In fact, big firms like Johns Manville and others had doctors who deliberately failed to inform the workers that they had developed disease when their x-rays clearly showed that they did. And the leading lawyer for Johns Manville was quoted, and I quote him in my book, as having told people back in the 1940s who questioned him, "We let our workers work themselves to death because otherwise they might sue us." So you had this enormous amount of culpability, and of course when juries began to hear this culpability in the 1970s in trials, they became enraged. I mean, I have actually seen jurors come back into a courtroom weeping. They were so angry. And so they not only awarded compensatory damages to the people who were dying of these dreadful tumors, always fatal mesothelioma and lung cancer, but they also began to award punitive damages, which are rare, but are awarded for outrageous and reckless misconduct as a deterrent to a company so that it will not do that in the future. Judges hate to award punitive damages, but in 1982 alone, 12 different juries across the United States, 120 people, awarded $6 million in punitive damages against Johns Manville. So no one should feel sorry for these asbestos companies that filed for bankruptcy or that got into trouble, and nor should they feel sorry for the insurance industry, Aetna, Travelers, Home. All these people insured the asbestos industry. Every one of those companies knew way back in the 1930s and 40s that asbestos was extremely hazardous. Their own records show that. But you see, until the restatement of tort law and the extension of strict liability to products like asbestos, the insurance industry simply believed, well, the workers can't sue. They've got to go to workman's comp. And workman's comp, of course, was, as I've said earlier, just a scam to settle on the cheap. So the insurance industry kept writing policies, liability policies for the asbestos industry as fast as it could put pen to paper. And then it got caught up. And now, of course, it's like a huge snowball. The losses are maybe anywhere from $40 to $60 billion. Lloyd's of London is perhaps going to go, well, the oldest insurer in the world and the most major one is the ultimate repository of insurance for the American asbestos industry. It is now apparently going to be going belly up or in danger of failing because of the asbestos litigation. My own point in the book and in my talk here in Fairbanks is that we need to learn from the asbestos tragedy because its lessons can be applied to other enormous hazards that exist out there. The asbestos problem is only one of many.
This is Paul Brodeur. He has been in Fairbanks as part of a symposium on the subject of asbestos health hazards. It's made possible by Alaska's unions and the University of Alaska Fairbanks Museum. Can you explain to me why you were essentially the first one to blow the whistle on this? If people have known since the 30s or before that asbestos was highly dangerous, was causing death to all handlers, why did it take decades and decades and decades?
Well, first of all, as I suggested, the asbestos industry, the chief executive officers of the asbestos industry and their attorneys made tremendous concerted efforts all during the 1930s and 40s to keep the word about the medical problems associated with asbestos away from the American public. And they were successful in doing that. The war came along, and because of the war effort, of course, there wasn't any talk about any of this. All the talk was simply building ships and getting going. And then after the war, the cover-up continued, and it involves the American medical profession. And it does till to this day. For example, we can maybe talk later on about the power line magnetic field problem. Mm-hmm. The American medical profession is saying nothing about this. The American medical profession said nothing about silicone breast implants all those years. The American medical profession said nothing about pesticides and insecticides. So very often it is, in the case of the magazine I work for, The New Yorker, we've had a long tradition of looking very carefully at major environmental and occupational problems. I think the very first article, the major one that we wrote, was John Hersey's Hiroshima in 1946. We wrote about the horrors of nuclear war and what had happened in Japan at a time when it was very unpopular to write that about that in the United States. And I find it curious, you know, that 12 years later up here at Fairbanks, project, the AEC wanted to, you know, dig a harbor up near Point Hope using 4 thermonuclear bombs.
Project Chariot.
Project Chariot in 1958, when we knew all along what a disaster this could be. It's almost insane to look back and think that they even remotely considered that. And then, of course, in the early 1960s, William Shawn, who was the editor of The New Yorker, published Rachel Carson's Silent Spring in the magazine. And that also was very unpopular. The chemical industry came out and threatened to withdraw its advertising from The New Yorker, and so did other big industrial corporations. They were enraged by that, and they attacked Rachel Carson personally.
What did you say the other night? They called her the hyperbolic.
Time magazine wrote a review of Silent Spring, in which they called her an eminent hyperbolist, and a senior scientist. A senior scientist, a man, of course, came out on television and said, "Who is this woman to be concerned about future generations? She's a spinster and doesn't even have children." He said that nationally, because no man would say that today, but it mm-hmm. gives you some idea of how the old boy academic and scientific network coalesces behind, you know, industry so often, all too often. And then I went to The New Yorker in 1958. Rachel Carson died in 1964. And I heard about asbestos in 68, and William Shawn encouraged me to write about it. I went on to write 4 books about it. All of my work appears in The New Yorker. Mm-hmm. And I sort of got into one tends to specialize in a magazine like The New Yorker. So my specialty soon became, in the 1970s, environmental and occupational problems. I wrote a bunch of pieces about asbestos, about the chemicals, about the destruction of the ozone layer, about microwave and radio and radio frequency radiation in radars, which is where I first heard about the Bemuse hazards up here in Alaska, and most recently about power line magnetic fields, which I think are going to turn out to be a huge problem. In fact, they already are.
I want to go to that next. You mentioned what's happened with asbestos raises lessons we need to learn now. Give us a couple, and then we'll use those to move into why electricity is something we should all be concerned about.
Sure. The asbestos industry set up animal experiments with asbestos at Saranac Lake Laboratories, at the Trudeau Foundation at Saranac Lake, New York, in the 1930s. And they had inhalation tests for guinea pigs and rats and all kinds of test animals, and they found that all these animals developed scarring of the lungs and tumors and the rest of it, but they suppressed the information. What it goes to show is that we should be testing products on animals and in other experiments and looking carefully at the human evidence, at the epidemiological evidence, before we allow them to be purveyed to the general population. For example, if in the 1940s and 50s, the government, state and federal health agencies, had taken seriously the medical evidence that had been in England for the previous quarter of a century and protected the health of American asbestos workers, We probably wouldn't have allowed it to have been sprayed into every school building, mm-hmm. high-rise building, and home across the land, where it's now costing billions of dollars to remove it. By the same token, when the chemical industry was burgeoning in the United States in the 50s, if we had protected the lives of some chemical workers who were dying at the average age of 50 from their exposure to toxic chemicals, particularly the chlorinated hydrocarbon chemicals, pesticides like DDT, et cetera, we wouldn't have allowed these chemicals to have been massively dumped into waste chemicals, to dumped into landfills all across the United States, where they are now contaminating groundwater. And so the testing procedure is what needs men. And now, because you see that as a society, we've learned very little. Because if you've read the newspapers this week, you find mm-hmm. that the Dow Chemical and Dow Corning, the makers of the silicone breast implants, knew 20 years ago from their animal studies that silicone interfered with a major component of the immune system of test animals, and failed to publish that data and failed to warn the Food and Drug Administration about it. See, incredibly enough, I think what very few Americans understand is that our federal regulatory agencies, like the Food and Drug Administration, don't do their own testing. All the money was taken away from these people under the Reagan administration, and they've never had much money for testing. They allow industry to do it, and industry is supposed to tell them the truth. Well, suppose industry doesn't tell them the truth. You get a thing. I mean, imagine the dimensions of the silicone breast implant problem. 1 million American women have had these implants in the last 15, 20 years. Well, they have just set aside, Dow Corning and the other manufacturers, a settlement trust fund of $4.3 billion, which is supposed to compensate some of these women. Well, now, no companies would do that, or nor their insurance companies, if they didn't know full well that there was a perfectly gigantic potential public health problem in the making here. And this is a clear indication. You take asbestos, you take the silicone, you could go to the Dalkin Shield, we could talk until the sun sets, which it never does around here these days, about these problems. And one of the major components of this problem is that there's no decent testing.
Okay, lessons then. As a nation, we must be aggressive and we must test. And I want to get back with a quick question on that in mm-hmm. just a second. And the other thing is that industry cannot be trusted to test itself.
Absolutely not, because you see, industry has a built-in conflict of interest.
Mm-hmm. I want to sell my product. I want
exactly.
to make money.
And Dow Chemical had not only a bunch of biologists who found that the silicone was dangerous in animals, but they also had a bunch of chemists. And the chemists said, no, this is inert. So they chose to believe their chemists. And here, for example, during Project Chariot, you had the physicists here at the University of Alaska and in Alaska and at the AEC, the Atomic Energy Commission, who said, well, they didn't want to believe that anything, that nuclear energy was anything. You know, Dr. Teller came up here and said he could shape the harbor at Point Barrow in the shape of a polar bear. And he even said, hey, if you got a mountain you don't like, we'll take the top off it. Well, thanks, you know. That's a certain kind of mentality. The people who warned about this problem were a very courageous professor of zoology named William Pruitt and Leslie Virick, who are a biologist, and a couple of other biologists. And the people who are concerned about the biological impacts are people you want to listen to. We're talking about human beings when you're talking about all this stuff, you know. So Dow would have been very well advised not to have listened to its chemists, but to have listened to the biologists that after all, it was going to implant these breast implants in living women.
I have a quick question for you, because there will be people in the audience who say, this man said we should do testing on animals, and they'll say to you, we shouldn't do testing on animals. What do you say to them in reply?
Well, I don't dismiss concern for animals and the fact that thousands of animals, guinea pigs and rats particularly, rats and mice, are sacrificed each year. But with the enormous problems that are posed in this society, where we use so many different products that are respirable, like asbestos, or that come into our systems through ingestion, like chemicals, there is no other way to protect human beings. And I must say that I come down on the side of protecting the lives of children and adults but particularly children. And if that means that we have to sacrifice animals to do it, I don't think we should ever sacrifice animals unnecessarily. But I think that in that, when you think of it in that balance, you come down on the side, I hope, of children.
Paul Brodeur with us today on Conversations. He was educated at Harvard in English, became a staff writer 5 years later in 1958 for The New Yorker. He's been there for 36 years, a senior staff writer. As he said, his emphasis is in environmental investigative reporting. He has taught magazine article workshops, writing workshops at Columbia and at Boston University. In his very early years, before he went over to The New Yorker, he was briefly 3 years with the United States Army Counterintelligence Corps. I'm Susan McGinnis. We're listening today to a discussion of asbestos and other hazards on Conversations. Let's switch hazards, if you will. Your book, Currents of Death, opens with a young epidemiologist named Nancy Wertheimer who decides pretty much on her own that she wants to look at why children are getting leukemia in the greater Denver area and works on that question for the next several years. What did Nancy Wertheimer find out about the proximity of children and leukemia with electric currents, with power lines?
Actually, she was a grandmother. and she's trained as an epidemiologist at Harvard University of Wisconsin. And she didn't have any money to do her study. She's done all her work with her own financing, which is amazing. And she did what many epidemiologists do. They're medical detectives. She drove around Greater Denver with two lists on the seat beside her. One list had children who had died of cancer in the Greater Denver area, and another list was children, the homes of children who did not develop cancer in that area. And she looked at the homes. She drove around to look at the homes, and she was trying to see if there was some kind of clue in the homes that might indicate why some children develop leukemia, which is the most common form of cancer in children, and why other children didn't. And after some years of investigation, it was actually quite soon that she realized that the homes of children who developed leukemia were unduly often near high current power lines. Now, the huge power distribution system is like, imagine it is a great spider web. And not all of it poses a hazard. In fact, only a relatively small portion of it does. The hazard is posed by high voltage and high current power lines, which carry enormous amounts of electricity and therefore give off strong magnetic fields. And Nancy Wertheimer realized very soon on, and every study has shown since her initial pioneering study was published in the American Journal of Epidemiology in 1979, that it is the magnetic fields given off by high voltage and high current power lines that pose the hazard. Electricity is a flow of charged particles. It's always accompanied by an electric and a magnetic field that can be measured separately. The electric field can be shielded by metal and other non-conducting materials, but nothing shields the magnetic field. It goes through concrete, it goes through lead, it goes through steel, it goes through anything, and obviously it goes through the human body. One leading oncologist has described the effect of a power line magnetic field in the human body as follows. The power line frequencies are 60 hertz. 60 times a second, the power distribution system vibrates back and forth, to and fro, 60 times a second. That's what called alternating current. Mm-hmm. So when you're standing beneath, say, a major high current or high voltage line, like the one going along University Avenue here in Fairbanks, if you're right under that, every molecule in your brain and body is vibrating to and fro 60 times a second to the rhythm of that power frequency field. Now, the magnetic field diminishes drastically with distance from such a power line. So if you get out 150, 200 feet, you're not going to have that phenomenon. But you don't have to be a rocket scientist or an oncologist to imagine, to intuit that kind of phenomenon, day in and day out, hour after hour, week upon week, month after month, year after year, isn't going to be very good for you, and particularly for a child who may be living in a house within 100 feet of such a line. who cells, particularly whose brain cells and blood-forming system cells are dividing so rapidly. Now, there have been, since Nancy Wertheimer's study, 10 childhood residential studies, studies of children living in homes near power lines, 7 out of the 10, and all published in the peer-reviewed medical literature around the world, show that children living in such homes near power lines are developing leukemia, brain cancer, and lymphoma at significantly greater rates than other children. And the Swedish government, looking at this evidence, and this is, by the way, just the childhood evidence, there are 60 studies of occupations, as well as animal studies and experimental evidence. The Swedish government, looking at this a year and a half ago, declared officially that henceforth we are going to operate, quote, on the assumption that power line magnetic fields cause cancer, particularly in children. Our own Environmental Protection Agency issued a report 4 years ago this spring, which stated that after reviewing the medical literature up to that point, they had decided, this EPA scientist, that power line magnetic fields are a, quote, probable cause of cancer in humans. Our government, the Bush administration, suppressed that report. And industry has been denying it ever since. And yet the Swedes, looking at the same evidence, have decided that that not only do they acknowledge the problem, but they're now setting about to reduce the exposure of the population. Well, what's happening in the United States is the same thing that happened with the asbestos. When government and industry, as they did with the asbestos problem, failed to deal with a major potential public health hazard, the last recourse of the injured citizen must and can only be the law. So people in the United States who have been injured, who are developing cancer, are beginning to sue the electric utility industry. Even more important from the point of view of trouble for the electric utility industry than the personal injury lawsuits, there are literally hundreds of property damage lawsuits. People who are living or who have built in or who have built homes near high current and high voltage power lines, and in California we're talking tens of thousands of people, and across the nation we're probably talking millions, mm-hmm. are not able to sell their homes because this story is getting out in spite of the government's efforts to suppress it. And in spite of the inaction of state and federal health agencies, the American people are losing between 30 and 50% of the value in homes near these power lines. Well, you can't have this happen. Something's going to give here. And believe me, if we were talking about this 2 or 3 years from now, you'll see how much it's going to give, because it's becoming a huge political issue in the United States.
Tell me why the government would want to suppress
this. Scared to death of the potential cost of this. You see, it's the reason for the cover. My first book about the power line hazard was called, as you said, Currents of Death. My most recent book, which is currently published by Little Brown, is called The Great Power Line Cover-Up. And I can tell you the reason for this cover-up in one sentence. And it's this: the moment a senior federal health official acknowledges that this is a problem, the way the EPA did 4 years ago before they were squelched, the American people are going to say, well, you have to do something about this. You can't just let me and my children live in this home. This is our castle, our treasure, the thing we've saved up all our money for. Get these lines out of here. And the government is scared to death. How many people are going to say that, and the extent of the cost? So right now, it's like the CEOs of these companies do when they find a big problem. Oh, my God, they say, let's see if we can get through this until I retire, and then we'll let the next guy deal with it. Mm-hmm. And this is exactly what the Bush administration did and what the Clinton administration is carrying on. The Clinton administration has got all of these economic problems with its health plan, care plan, you know, that's such a big controversial thing. And the last thing it wants is a major public health hazard that may cost millions of dollars to fix.
Last year on Larry King, you were called an environmental terrorist and an intellectual terrorist, I gather, in the same sentence. Why? It's on this issue.
Yes. The physicists around the nation are locked into the concrete of a very orthodox idea that radiation of this kind, radiation from radar, non-ionizing radiation, microwaves from radar, radio frequency, and power line electric and magnetic fields cannot cause effects in tissue, in biological effects, except in the presence of heat. And I wrote about this 15 years ago when I took on the Air Force, which has been lying to the American people for years about the harmful effects of microwave radiation from its radars. I took them on by pointing out that, and now even the Air Force admits, that there are literally hundreds of studies showing non-thermal effects. And all the effects that I've been talking about, the cancer in children, starting with Nancy Wertheimer's study, there are no heating effects from those magnetic fields. So now the physicists of the country are saying, well, if there are no heating effects, since we believe that these things cannot happen except in the presence of thermodynamic changes, then these changes that you're seeing in the human studies, in these childhood studies, 7 out of 10, 60% of all the occupational studies, they can't be happening. Therefore, anybody who says they are happening is deliberately misinforming the American, and he's an intellectual terrorist. Well, I'll plead guilty to that, but I have a fairly good track record about asbestos and the ozone layer and the chemicals. And let me say this about the evidence about the power line magnetic fields. Never before in the history of occupational or environmental medicine, in this century, in other words, mm-hmm. has there been this much epidemiological evidence about the cancer-producing quality of any agent, and that evidence subsequently declared to be invalid, and that agent subsequently declared to be benign. So this will be the first time that had ever happened. And what I say to the physicists is, you better start looking at the biological information that's coming out, because the experimental evidence clearly shows that power line magnetic fields interfere with the ability of cells to communicate with each other. And no place is this more evident than in what I think will be the smoking gun of this whole controversy, the breast cancer connection with power line magnetic fields. There are now 4 studies showing that men exposed to these fields, power linemen, people like that, are developing breast cancer at rates 6 to 10 times expected. Breast cancer in men is a vanishingly rare disease, 1 in 100,000 American men each year. But it is not a vanishingly rare disease in women. In American women, between one in every 8 and 9 American women will develop breast cancer in her life. So there are 4 studies showing male breast cancer elevated 6 to 10 times above what should be occurring among people exposed to power line magnetic fields. Well, under the microscope, histologically speaking, breast cancer in men is the identical disease to breast cancer in women. So wouldn't you think that since there's an epidemic of cancer, breast cancer in American women, that something like power line magnetic fields, which are believed to be a promoter of cancer, would be of enormous importance to women? I'm not saying for one moment you understand that the power line magnetic fields are the only cause. It's undoubtedly a multiple cause disease, diet, genetics, chemical exposures, things like that. But now you have this enormous accumulation of information. A few months ago, the first female occupational study was done. Women who work in electrical occupations are dying of breast cancer at a 50% statistically significant greater rate than other women. Mm. 2 different animal studies, one out of Germany, one out of the Soviet Union, showed that rats exposed to power line magnetic fields are developing mammary tumors at far greater rates. Would you believe that not a single animal study has ever been done in the United States? Because no one's around to finance it, and the utility industry won't? Now, finally, the experimental evidence, which should be of particular interest to the physicists, is any number of studies, 6 published in the peer-reviewed medical literature, show that magnetic fields suppress the ability of the pineal gland in test animals and human females to secrete melatonin. Melatonin is a hormone that is an oncostatic agent that is a component of the immune system that protects against breast cancer specifically. So you have experimental evidence, animal evidence, and human evidence, and still these clowns are going around saying that there's no problem. Well, let me tell you, 5 years from now, you'll see what, you know, I'm absolutely convinced that there will be an enormous connection. There is an enormous connection right now. And women should be very careful who are working with computer terminals to make sure that they're an arm's length, fingertips extended from them, and that they're not at least 3 or 4 feet from the nearest computer. It's particularly true in newsrooms and in insurance offices, places where you have huge numbers of these computers, and should be very careful of magnetic field exposure in any event.
Are you writing on this subject?
Well, I've written two books in the last 5 years.
But I mean specifically on breast cancer and...
In my most recent book, I have, yes, talked about a lot of this evidence, although some of the evidence, my book was published last September, right. The study, the animal, one of the animal studies and the occupational study among women have just come out since the book was published.
Okay. So if you're looking for more on this subject, as Paul says, you may not get the absolute latest on... breast cancer, but some information will be in the Great Powerline cover-up, subtitled How the Utilities and the Government Are Trying to Hide the Cancer Hazards Posed by Electromagnetic Fields. It's published by Little Brown, and its publishing date, 1993. Before that, Currents of Death, Powerline's Computer Terminals and an Attempt to Cover Up Their Threat to Your Health, Simon & Schuster book published in 1989. The first one on electricity was actually on radar, right?
Yes, on electromagnetic fields.
Yeah. The Zapping of America, 1977, yeah. Was a Norton book.
Mm-hmm.
Well, practical information about women relative to computer terminals, PCs, and breast cancer is helpful. Tell me what citizens, grassroots responses can be to something as ubiquitous as a power line problem, or as distant as DES was, or silicone implants are?
Well, in my recent book, I have given examples of citizen action groups who have forced school districts, persuaded is a better word, school districts and their fellow citizens, to evacuate portions of schools that are right next to power lines where the magnetic fields can, they're very easy to measure, by the way. You can measure them with a $75 device called a Gauss meter, where the magnetic fields are high enough to cause biological hazard to the children and the teachers. As I've already suggested, people can learn to sit at least 30 inches, 25 inches away from the monitor of the screen of a computer terminal, and to sit at least 3 to 4 feet, to arrange their office space so they're sitting 3 to 4 feet at least from the sides or backs of the nearest monitors. What women need to avoid is to be sitting within the envelope. See, the magnetic field only exists out around a computer terminal in an envelope, the same way it does in an envelope around the wire. And it diminishes drastically with distance. So distance is always the key. The studies out of Finland, Sweden, Denmark show clearly that women working with these monitors in close proximity are suffering miscarriages and spontaneous abortion at rates that are staggeringly high. Mm-hmm. Animal studies out of Sweden all during the 1980s showed the effects on fetuses of test animals. Would you believe that we have never done an animal study in the United States of the sawtooth waveform coming out of computer terminals, such as the power of the electronic industry? Here we are, the greatest technological nation in the world, and these studies are coming out now for 15 years out of Scandinavia, and not one in the United States. I mean, it's unbelievable.
Well,
it's a joke in bad taste.
Nancy Wertheimer and her partner,
Ed Leeper.
Thank you. In their first article for the Journal of Epidemiology, opened it by saying something about electricity became established long before we started thinking about environmental effects, environmental impact statements, and the like. Isn't that part of the problem?
Oh, sure. Just like asbestos.
Plug it in and turn it on.
Just like asbestos. Asbestos became ubiquitous before anybody tumbled onto the fact, except industry, that it was a hazard. Now, of course, we live in an electronic society. We couldn't do without our computers. The newspapers couldn't even publish. So we're going to have to work around them. But you see, the dynamic struggle in society is people say, hey, there's no problem here. Just keep on working. Keep on trucking, fella. I mean, they said that to the asbestos workers, and look what we got. We've got the most monumental public health disaster in the history of modern life. The greatest public health tragedy in the history of the United States. And we can have even greater ones now because electricity is so ubiquitous. Now, obviously, we're not going to do without electricity, and no one suggests that we should. What I suggest is that we do a sensible thing. When you're sick, you acknowledge that you're ill. Then you go to your doctor and you get him to identify where the disease is, a diagnosis it's called, and then you remedy the situation by following the doctor's orders. Either you go to the pharmacy and get some medicine, or you go to the hospital. Okay. The Swedish government has looked at the very same evidence that we've got about the power line magnetic fields, and they have acknowledged the problem, the same way our EPA tried to do before it was suppressed by the Bush administration. But we aren't even now in that first acknowledgement problem. We're denying this. Our state and federal health agencies are denying that there's a problem. That is stupid, because that's what leads to terrible trouble. But if we acknowledge it and then set about to identify where it exists in its most easily soluble form, I've suggested the nation's schools would be a good place to start, and then remedy it by either rerouting these dangerous power lines or reconfiguring them, which is possible, or if worse comes to worse, burying them, and the technology is there and the utility industry knows clearly about it, burying power lines in a way in which the currents are in balance and the magnetic fields are canceled out. And by the way, this burying will, in the long run, 10 years, their own studies show, save them money because of less maintenance. There are solutions here. And you don't need to panic. In your own home, you can be careful. Some people, for example, if they live in a home right next to a power line, are taking their children and putting them on the other side of the house to sleep. That's a smart thing to do. They're measuring their homes to find out if the child's bed is near the fuse box or where the wires come into the house, because that will often be a very small but highly localized place for strong magnetic fields. And you can do all kinds of things. I don't believe in being alarmist or sensationalist about this, but I do believe in being intelligent and acknowledging when a problem exists, identifying where it exists, and setting about to remedy it. To not do this is gross ignorance. And I find the physicists grossly ignorant about this. In fact, I have said on the national television, on Larry King Live Show, to a senior physicist from Yale, I reminded him what the, and I remind your listeners, what the physicists said about radioactivity at the end of the Second World War. They assured Americans that there was no problem here. And we know what happened. We know that that strontium-90 got into the grass and into the cow's milk and became a huge problem. It's why we stopped largely why we stopped testing. So they were wrong about that, and I think physicists ought to be very careful. I don't say they shouldn't discuss their beliefs as freely as anybody else, but they ought to be very careful before they get into areas of biology that they essentially know very little about. It's very arrogant for the physicists who have declared that at the end of the war and been so wrong, and now to be declaring that power line magnetic fields are harmless in the face of overwhelming biological evidence to the contrary.
And you think one of the solutions for the future, or maybe better phrased, one of the lessons to learn is that scientists have to work together in a interdisciplinary manner, physicists with chemists, with biologists, with...
Well, there are many problems here. One of the problems, for example, is that the electric utility industry today is recruiting senior researchers at prestigious institutions all across the United States, Harvard, Yale, Columbia, University of Alabama, UCLA, USC, Stanford University. Senior researchers there, even deans of some of those medical schools, are paid consultants of the electric utility industry. And what's happening in the United States, I fear to tell you, is that all too often science is for sale. We've got to have the medical and scientific profession ought to institute some rules about where money can come from, this kind of consultantship thing, because what these people are being paid is $50,000-$75,000 a pop to go on radio or television and say, hey, there's no problem here. Now, let me tell you, that's not the role the scientific community ought to be playing in our nation. And there's no peer review within the scientific community to stop this.
Here's a hard question. It's a what's a guy to do question. If the funding for research is being cut back because of economic problems in some areas, if academic institutions are under budgetary problems and cutbacks, and if an industry offers money for study or money for representation, that's very attractive.
Of course it's attractive, and it's a very difficult thing to call, and you put your finger on an enormous problem. In my profession, in journalism, in our profession, there's an old saying, When you want to find out why someone is saying something or not saying something, or why they're doing something and not doing something, you follow the money trail. And the problem with scientists, anybody accepting money from industry, is what kind of data are they putting out? Some scientists, of course, are extremely honest and forthright and let the chips fall where they may. But I can give you examples going back all the way into the asbestos industry, and particularly now in this power line magnetic field, where scientists are shading off their studies or designing them in ways that will be favorable to the people who are paying them. I mean, you get a scientist who's getting $850,000, say, for an epidemiological study from the electric utility industry, and the utility industry says to him, you know, I'm not ever suggesting that there's a payment that goes to that scientist's falsified data. I've never heard of that. That's not the way it's done. What happens is the industry says to him, look, we'll give you $1 million for this study, but this is the way we want you to design it. Instead of looking at the cable splicers in the telephone industry, we want you to look at all 52,000 New York Telephone Company employees, including the people that made sandwiches. That's what happened with a very famous epidemiological study. And what happened is that's how you dilute the study.
The problem,
you won't find the disease in that huge pool of 52,000, but when you look at the 4,500 cable splicers, as Genevieve Matanoski, a very well-known epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins, did, there she found that leukemia was 7 times expected. Cancer of all types was elevated because these were the men who went up the poles and down in the trenches in New York and were exposed to the power line magnetic fields from the electric wires.
I see.
And so that's how it's done. And as far as this business, however, which is a separate issue, of scientists being recruited to sit on literature review committees. In other words, these people that I've just ticked off from these institutions, Harvard, Yale, et cetera, not one of them has ever done a biological study or published it in the peer-reviewed medical literature. All they've been hired to do by industry is to review the literature that exists and give their opinion, their assertion, that it really doesn't add up to much of a problem, and are being paid $70,000 a pop for this. Hey, come on, this is a scam, and there ought to be, the only way that it can stop is for there be some strong peer review within the scientific community. Now, when three senior scientists from the National Cancer Institute pulled this stunt, I exposed them in the New Yorker and in my first book, Currents of Death. They were all reprimanded by the National Institutes of Health for breaking government rules for outside income. Well, universities ought to have that too. A university such as Harvard, my alma mater, should not allow a senior epidemiologist at the Harvard School of Public Health, which has already occurred, to be accepting money from the electric utility industry and going and testifying at government committees that there's no problem here.
The same kind of accountability we're now requiring for politicians
Absolutely.
Needs to be required.
Absolutely. And there needs to be much more peer review in the medical and scientific profession about this.
Another question, and this is unfortunately the last one. We have just a couple of minutes left. About what people can do. Is the answer, one of the answers, and I don't mean this in any way literally, but in the largest sense, that we must read the labels. We must pay a great deal of attention to what's in our air, in our food, in our medical advice, in everything.
Well, last night in my talk here at the university, I quoted one of your local authors, Dan O'Neill, who has a book coming out called The Firecracker Boys, which is all about the Project Chariot boondoggle of 35 years ago. And in Weill Askins, he wrote about an article about this, in which he suggested that, and I've agreed with this for all my career, that there needs to be rigorous skepticism, questioning, and debate and dissent about such products and such projects. And that this kind of dissent doesn't weaken but strengthens our society. And that's what I think you need to have. I think you need to have a new skepticism on the part of people about products that are out there which may be hazardous. I'm absolutely flabbergasted that 1 million American women could accede to a process of putting something foreign into their bodies like silicone breast implants and not question the long-term effects of this kind of thing. I think we've got to start doing that rather than simply accepting the assurances, what Rachel Carson called little pills of half-truth, that industry so often puts out about its products, because willy-nilly then we become the test animals. These women have become the test animals, the same way women who use the Dalkin Shield intrauterine device became the test animals, the same way millions of American workers became the test animals for asbestos, and now millions of Americans becoming the test animals for the biological effects of power line magnetic fields. I would rather see some of those things tested on animals first. Now, of course, with the electricity, I think that would have been quite impossible because, as you know, electricity came in at the turn of the century. But in all of these problems, X-rays, that's a good one. X-rays were invented by Roentgen in 1897. By 1915, American radiologists were developing cancer of the bone of the hand at extraordinary rates because they were putting their hands under their instruments to focus them. And Madame Curie, as you know, died of radium poisoning. And at international conference after international conference during the 20s and 30s, our radiologists were warned by European radiologists, particularly the Soviets, the Russians, that low-level exposure to X-rays was hazardous. They did nothing. They irradiated the ovaries of women for infertility, the thyroids of people for tonsillitis, scalps for ringworm, faces for acne. I mean, I remember as a kid, you know, you could walk in and see the bones of your feet in the fluoroscope. All that stopped in 1950 when, as a corollary of the Hiroshima investigations, a study showed that American radiologists were developing leukemia at a rate 1,000 times greater than all other physicians combined. At that point, the radiologists stopped taking these pictures. Now, you go into the radiologist's office, you go in a little lead room, lined room, a technician throws a lead apron over you, ducks out the door and pushes a button. That's how that happened. All those years, for the first 50 years of this century, human beings became the test animals. This is what needs to stop. And then some of these tragedies can be averted.
Paul Bridger, thank you very much. On Conversations today, some of the things we didn't think were hazardous that seemed to be. I'm Susan McGinnis. Thanks to Paul Bridger. Take a look for The Great Power Line Cover-Up, Currents of Death, both on electricity, on asbestos, The Outrageous Misconduct, posed in 1985. And join me again for another conversation next week.